conditions 2,000 feet below. "I think I'm getting more comfortable with my job," Ethan said. "You've been rigorously studying the resident files?"
"I've gotten through all of them once."
"Your predecessor, Mr. Pope, had them memorized."
"I'll get there."
"Glad to hear it. But you weren't studying them this morning, correct?"
"You were watching me."
"Not watching you, but your office popped up a few times on the monitors. What was that you were reading? I couldn't make it out."
"The Sun Also Rises."
"Ah, Hemingway, one of my favorites. You know, I still believe that great art will be created here. I brought along our pianist, Hector Gaither, for that explicit reason. I have other renowned novelists and painters in suspension, poets, and we're always looking for talent to nurture in the school.
Ben is thriving in his art class."
Ethan bristled internally at Pilcher's mention of his son, but he only said, "The residents of Pines are in no state of mind to make art."
"What do you mean by that, Ethan?"
Pilcher asked it like a therapist might, the question charged with intellectual curiosity, not aggression. "They live under constant surveillance. They know they can never leave. What kind of art would a repressed society possibly be motivated to create?"
Pilcher smiled.
"Ethan, to hear you talk, I wonder if you're fully on board with me, if you actually believe in what we're doing."
"Of course I believe."
"Of course you do.
A report came across my desk today from one of my nomads just returned from a 2-week mission. He saw a swarm of abbeys 2,000 strong only 20 miles from the center of Wayward Pines. They were moving across the plains east of the mountains, chasing a herd of buffalo. Every day I'm reminded how vulnerable we are in this valley, how tenuous, how fragile our existence. And you sit there and look at me like I'm running the GDR or the Khmer Rouge. You don't like it. I can respect that. Hell, I wish it could be different. But there are reasons for the things I do, and these reasons are based upon the preservation of life, of our species."
"Aren't there always reasons?"
"You're a man of conscience, and I appreciate that," Pilcher said. "I wouldn't have someone in your position of power who wasn't. Every resource I have, every person under my employ, is devoted to one thing. Keeping the 461 people in that valley, your wife and son included, safe."
"What about the truth?" Ethan asked.
"In some environments, safety and truth are natural-born enemies. I would think a former employee of the federal government could grasp that concept."
Ethan glanced over at the wall of screens. On one in the lower left-hand corner, his wife appeared, sitting alone in her office on Main Street, motionless, bored. The screen adjacent to hers showed a camera feed unlike anything Ethan had seen, a bird's-eye view of something flying 100 feet above a dense forest at a considerable rate of speed.
"What's that camera feed?" Ethan asked, pointing at the wall.
"Which one?" The image was replaced by a camera shot from inside the opera house. "It's gone now. But it looked like something flying at a treetop level."
"Oh, that's just one of my UAVs."
"UAV?"
"Unmanned aerial vehicle. It's an MQ-9 Reaper drone. We send them out every so often on reconnaissance missions. Has a range of about 1,000 miles. Today I believe it's flying south to do a loop around the Great Salt Lake."
"Ever find anything?"
"Not yet." "Look, Ethan, I'm not asking you to like all of this. I don't like it."
"Where are we going?" Ethan asked, as the image of his wife was replaced with the image of two boys building sandcastles in a sandbox.
"As a species, I mean."
He fixed his gaze back on Pilcher. "I get what you've done here, that you've preserved our existence far beyond what evolution had in mind. But was it just for this? So a small contingent of humanity could live in a valley under 24/7 surveillance, shielded from the truth, occasionally forced to kill one of their own?
It's not a life, David. It's a prison sentence. And you've made me the warden. I want the best for these people, for my family.
Pilcher rolled back in his chair away from the desk, spun it around, and stared through the glass at the town he had made.
"We've been here 14 years, Ethan. There are less than 1,000 of us, and hundreds of millions of them. Sometimes the best you can do is simply survive."
The camouflaged tunnel door closed shut behind him. Ethan stood alone in the woods. He moved away from the rock outcropping back toward the road. The sun had already dropped behind the western wall of cliffs, a crisp golden quality to the sky, a night is coming chill to the air. The road into Pines was empty, and Ethan walked down the middle of the double yellow. Home was 1040 6th Street, a Victorian just a few blocks from Main, yellow with white trim, pleasant and creaky. Ethan moved across the flagstones and up onto the porch. He opened the screen door, the solid wood door, stepped inside, said, "Honey, I'm home." There was no answer, only the silent, clenched energy of an empty house. He topped the coat rack with his cowboy hat and sat down on a ladder-back chair to wrestle off his boots. In sock feet, he crossed to the kitchen. The milk had come. 4 glass bottles rattled against one another when he pulled open the door to the fridge. He grabbed one and carried it down the hallway into the study. This was Ethan's favorite room in the house. If he sat in the oversized upholstered chair by the window, he could bask in the knowledge that he wasn't being watched. Most buildings in Pines had 1 or 2 blind spots. On his 3rd trip to the superstructure, he'd gotten his hands on the surveillance schematics for his house, memorized the location of every camera. He'd asked Pilcher if he could have them removed and been denied. Pilcher wanted Ethan to have the full experience of living under surveillance so he could relate to the people under his authority. There was comfort in knowing that in this moment no one could see him. Of course, they knew his precise location at all times thanks to the microchip embedded under his hamstring. Ethan had known better than to ask if he could be exempt from that security measure. Ethan popped the top off the glass bottle and took a swig. It wasn't the kind of thing he could say to Teresa with people listening, but he'd often thought that out of all the terrible hardships attendant to their life in Pines, no privacy, no freedom, the ever-present threat of death, this daily milk from the dairy in the southeast corner of the valley had to be the one bright spot. It was cold and creamy and fresh, with a grassy sweetness. Out the window, he could see into the next-door neighbor's backyard. Jennifer Rochester knelt over a raised flowerbed, scooping in handfuls of soil from a red wheelbarrow. He recalled her file before he could stop the thought. In her past life, she'd been a professor of education at Washington State University. Here in Pines, she waited tables 4 nights a week at the Biergarten. With the exception of a brutal interrogation that almost didn't take, she had been a model resident. Stop. He didn't want to think about work, about the private details of his neighbors' lives. What must they think of him under the surface? He shuddered at his life. They hit him occasionally, those moments of despair. There was no way out, no other man he could be, not if he wanted to keep his family safe. That had been made abundantly clear. Ethan knew he should probably read the report on McCall, but instead he opened the drawer in the accent table beside him and took out the book of poetry. Robert Frost. A short collection of his nature poems. Whereas Hemingway had crushed him this morning, in Frost, Ethan always found solace. He read for an hour. Of mending walls and snowy woods and roads not taken. The sky darkened. He heard his wife's footsteps on the porch. Ethan met her at the door. "How was your day?" he asked. Teresa's eyes seemed to whisper, "I sat behind a desk for 8 hours at a meaningless job and didn't speak to another soul." But she forced a smile and said, "It was great. And yours?" "I met with the man responsible for this prison we call home and picked up a secret file on one of our neighbors." "Mine was great, too." She ran her hand down his chest. "I'm glad you didn't change yet. I love you in uniform." Ethan embraced his wife, breathed in her smell, fingers gliding through her long blonde hair.
I was thinking, she said.
Yeah?
Ben won't be home from Matthew's for another hour.
Is that right?
She took Ethan by the hand and pulled him toward the staircase.
You sure? He asked. They'd only been together twice in the 2 weeks since their reunion, both times in Ethan's favorite chair in the study, Teresa sitting in his lap, his hands on her hips, an awkward entanglement.
I want you, she said.
Let's go in the study.
No, she said. Our bed.
He followed her up the steps and down the second-floor hallway, the hard wood groaning under their footfalls. They stumbled, kissing into the bed, their hands all over each other, Ethan trying to ground himself in the moment, but he couldn't push the cameras out of his mind. One behind the thermostat on the wall beside the bathroom door. One in the light fixture in the ceiling, looking straight down on their bed. He was hesitating, conflicted, and Teresa sensed it.
"What's wrong, baby?" she said.
"Nothing." They were standing beside the bed. Out the window, the lights of Pines were coming on, street lamps, porch lights, house lights. A cricket started up, its chirping sliding through the open window. Quintessential sound of a peaceful night. Only it wasn't real. There were no crickets anymore. The sound came from a tiny speaker hidden in a bush. He wondered if his wife knew that. Wondered how much of the truth she suspected.
"Do you want me?"
Teresa asked in that no-bullshit tone he'd fallen for the first time they'd met.
"Of course I do. So do something about it."
He took his time unbuttoning the back of her white summer dress, badly out of practice, but there was something wonderfully terrifying because of the rust. Not like high school, but close. A lack of control that had him hard before they'd even made it into the room. He tried to pull the covers over them, but she wouldn't have it. Told him she wanted to feel the cool breeze coming through the window across the surface of her skin. It was a good old-fashioned bed and, like the rest of the house, creaky as hell. The bed springs squeaked, and as Teresa moaned, Ethan tried to put the knowledge of the camera above them out of his mind. Pilcher had assured him that watching couples in their private moments was strictly forbidden, that camera feeds were always killed when the clothes came off. But Ethan wondered if that was true. Or if some surveillance tech was watching as he fucked his wife. Studying Ethan's bare ass, the bend of Teresa's leg as they wrapped around his body. Their first two times together, Ethan had come before Teresa. Now the thought of the camera above him cut into the pleasure. He used the anger to make himself last. Teresa came with a vengeance that reminded Ethan of how good they could be together. He let himself finish, and then they were still, breathless, and he could feel her heart jackhammering against his ribs. The evening air almost cold where it grazed his sweaty skin. It might have been a perfect moment, but the knowledge of everything elbowed in. Would he reach the point one day when he could shut that off? Just take these unexpected respites of peace for their surface beauty and forget the underlying horror? Was that how people managed to live here for years without losing their minds?
"So we can still do that," he said, and they laughed.
"Next time we'll take off the training wheels," she said.
"I like the sound of that."
He rolled over and Teresa curled into him. Ethan made sure her eyes were closed. Then he smiled straight up at the ceiling and raised his middle finger. Ethan and Teresa worked on dinner together, chopping side by side on the butcher block counter. It was harvest time in the community gardens, the end of the season, and the Burke's fridge was loaded down with their share of fresh veggies and fruit. These were, without a doubt, the prime eating months of the year in Wayward Pines. Once the leaves had been burnt with frost and the snow line had begun its rapid descent to the valley floor, the food took a disastrous turn for the freeze-dried. October through March, they could look forward to 6 months of prepackaged, dehydrated shit. Teresa had already warned Ethan that walking through the town grocery in December was like shopping for a space mission. Nothing but shelf after shelf of chrome-colored packaging labeled with the most outrageous dares. Creme brulee, grilled cheese sandwich, filet mignon, lobster tail. She had already threatened to serve him freeze-dried steak and lobster for their Christmas dinner.
They had just finished preparing the hearty salad, onions, radishes, and raspberries over a bed of spinach and red lettuce, when Ben crashed through the front door, rouge-cheeked, smelling of boy sweat and the outdoors. Still caught in that delicate blink of time between boy and man. Teresa went to her son and kissed him and asked about his day. Ethan turned on the vintage Philips, a tube radio from the 1950s in immaculate condition. Pilcher had inexplicably put one in every inhabited house. Surfing was easy with one station to choose from. Most of the time, it just blared static, but there were one or two talk shows, and always, between 7 and 8 o'clock, dinner with Hector. Hector Gaither had been a moderately famous concert pianist in his past life. In Pines, he taught lessons to anyone who wanted to learn, and every night of the week played music for the town. Ethan turned up the volume, heard Hector's voice as he joined his family. "Good evening, Wayward Pines. Hector Gaither here." At the head of the table, Ethan dished out servings of their salad. "I'm sitting at my Steinway, a gorgeous Boston baby grand," first to his wife. "Tonight, I'll be playing the Goldberg Variations, a work originally composed for harpsichord by Johann Sebastian Bach," then to his son. "The construction of this piece is an aria followed by 30 variations. Please enjoy." As Ethan served himself and took a seat, he heard the creak of the piano bench come crackling through the speaker. After dinner, the Burks took bowls of homemade ice cream out onto the porch, sat in rocking chairs, eating and listening. Through the open windows of the neighboring houses, Ethan could hear Hector's music. It filled the valley. Precise and radiant notes bubbling up between the mountain walls that had become ruddy with alpenglow. They stayed out late. A millennium without air or light pollution made for pitch-black skies. The stars didn't just appear anymore, they exploded. Diamonds on black velvet. You couldn't tear your eyes away. Ethan reached over and held Teresa's hand. Bach and galaxies. The night grew cool. When Hector finished, people clapped inside their homes. Across the street, a man shouted, "Bravo! Bravo!" Ethan looked over at Teresa. Her eyes were wet. He said, "You okay?" She nodded, wiping her face. "I'm just so glad to have you home." Ethan finished the dishes, headed upstairs. Ben's room was at the far end of the hall, and the door was closed, just a razor line of light visible underneath. Ethan knocked. "Come in." Ben was sitting up in bed sketching, charcoal on butcher paper. Ethan eased down on the comforter, asked, "Can I take a look?" Ben lifted his arms. The sketch was the boy's current vantage point from the bed, the wall, the desk, the window frame, the points of light outside which were visible through the glass. "That's amazing," Ethan said. "It's not exactly what I want. The night through the window doesn't really look like night." "I'm sure it'll get there. Hey, I picked up a book from the coffee shop today." Ben perked up. "What is it?" "It's called The Hobbit." "I never heard of it." "It was one of my favorite books when I was your age. I thought maybe I could read it to you." "I know how to read, Dad." "I know, but I haven't read this in years. Might be fun to read it together." "Is it scary?" "It has some scary parts. Go brush your teeth and hurry back." Ethan sat against the headboard, reading by the light of a bedside table lamp. Ben was asleep before the end of the first chapter, dreaming, Ethan hoped, of dungeons deep and caverns old, of something other than Wayward Pines. Ethan set the paperback aside and cut the lamp, pulled the blanket up to his son's shoulders. He laid his hand down against Ben's back. Nothing better in the world than feeling the rise and fall of his child's sleeping respirations. Ethan had still not recovered from his son growing up in Wayward Pines, doubted it was something he would ever accept. There were small things which he tried to tell himself were better. Tonight, for instance. Had Ben grown up in the old world, Ethan would probably have entered his son's bedroom to find him glued to an iPhone, texting friends, watching television, playing video games, Twitter and Facebook. Ethan didn't miss those things, didn't wish that his son was growing up in a world where people stared at screens all day, where communication had devolved into the tapping of tiny letters, and humanity lived by and large for the endorphin kick from the ping of a received text or a new email. Instead, he'd found his almost teenage son passing his time before bed by sketching. Hard to feel bad about that. But it was the years to come that weighed down on Ethan's heart with the black pressure of depression. What did Ben have to look forward to? There would be no higher learning, no real career. Gone were the days of, you can be whatever you want to be, whatever you set your mind to, just follow your heart and your dreams. Golden Age platitudes of an extinct species. When people failed to pair up on their own, marriages in pines were often suggested. And even when they weren't, the pool of potential mates wasn't exactly deep. Ben would never see Paris, or Yellowstone, might never fall in love. He would never have the experience of going away to college, or on a honeymoon, or driving across the country nonstop, spur of the moment, just because he was 22 and could. Ethan hated the surveillance and the abbeys and Pines's culture of illusion. But what kept him up with his mind racing late into the night were thoughts of his son. Ben had lived in Pines for 5 years, almost as long as he'd lived in the world before. Whereas Ethan suspected that the adult residents of Pines struggled every day with the memory of their past lives, Ben was very much a product of this town, of this strange new time. Not even Ethan was privy to the things his son was being taught in school. Pilcher kept a pair of his men in plain clothes on school property at all times, and parents weren't allowed inside. 3:30 a.m. Ethan lay awake in his bed, his wife in his arms, miles from sleep. He could feel Teresa's eyelashes scraping against his chest with each blink. What are you thinking? The question had haunted their marriage before, but in Pines it had assumed an entirely new gravity. In the 14 days they'd been together, Teresa had never broken the surface illusion. Of course, she had welcomed Ethan back home. There'd been a tearful reunion, but 5 years as a resident of Pines had made her a stone-cold pro. There was no talk of where Ethan had been or of his tumultuous integration. No mention or discussion of the strange events surrounding his becoming sheriff, or what he might now know. Sometimes he thought he caught a glint of something in Teresa's eyes, an acknowledgement of their circumstance, a suppressed desire to communicate on a forbidden level. But like a good actor, she never broke character. More and more he was coming to realize that living in Pines was like living in an elaborate play whose curtain never closed. Everyone had their parts. Shakespeare could have been writing about Pines. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. Ethan had already played a few of his own. Downstairs, the telephone was ringing. Teresa sat up as if she'd been spring-loaded, no sign of bleariness, snapped instantly to attention, her face gone tight with fear. "Is it everyone's phone?" she asked, her voice filled with dread. Ethan climbed out of bed. "No, honey. Go back to sleep. It's just ours. It's just for me." Ethan caught it on the sixth ring, standing in his boxers in the living room, the rotary phone clutched between his shoulder and his ear. "For a moment I wondered if you were going to answer," Pilcher's voice. He'd never called Ethan at home before. "Do you know what time it is?" Ethan said. "Terribly sorry to have woken you. Did you get a chance to read the surveillance report on Peter McCall?" "Yeah," Ethan lied. "But you didn't go and talk with him like I suggested, did you?" "I was planning to go first thing tomorrow." "Don't bother. He's decided to take his leave of us tonight."
"He's outside?"
"Yeah."
"So maybe he went for a walk."
30 seconds ago, his signal reached the curve of the road at the end of town and kept right on heading south."
"What do you want me to do?"
There was a beat of silence on the other end of the line. Somehow, Ethan could feel the frustration coming through like a heat lamp. Pilcher said evenly, "Stop him. Talk some sense into him."
"But I don't know exactly what you want me to say.
I realize this is your first runner. Don't worry about what to say. Just trust your gut. I'll be listening."
"Listening?"
A dial tone blared in Ethan's ear. He crept upstairs and dressed in the darkness. Teresa was still awake, sitting up in bed and watching as he threaded his belt through the loops.
"Everything okay, honey?"
she asked. "Fine," Ethan said. "Work stuff." "Yeah, just have to stop one of our neighbors from trying to leave our little slice of paradise in the middle of the night. No big deal. Nothing weird here." Ethan walked over and kissed his wife on the forehead. "I'll be back as soon as I can, hopefully before morning." She didn't say anything, only grabbed his hand and squeezed hard enough to move the bones. Nighttime in Wayward Pines. A wonderland of stillness. The crickets turned off. So quiet, Ethan could hear the street lamps humming, the pounding of his own biologic engine. He walked down to the curb and climbed into the black Ford Bronco with a light bar across the roof and on the doors the exact WP emblem that was engraved on his sheriff's star. The engine gargled. Ethan shifted into gear. Tried to pull gently out into the street, but the 4.9-liter straight-six had been bored out and was loud as hell. The noise would undoubtedly wake people. Cars were rarely driven in Pines. You could cross town on foot in 15 minutes. Cars were never driven in Pines at night. Their purpose was decorative, and anyone whose slumber was disturbed by the roar of Ethan's Bronco would know that something had come off the rails. He turned on to Main and headed south. After the hospital, he hit the high beams and pushed the gas pedal into the floor, accelerating into a narrow corridor of tall pines. With the window down, the cold forest air streamed in. He drove down the middle of the road, tires straddling the double yellow, imagining there was no turn coming, that soon the road would begin to climb. Out of this valley, away from this town. He would reach down and turn on the radio, surf the airwaves until he found a station that played the oldies. It would be a 3-hour trip back to Boise. Nothing like driving on an open road at night with the windows down and good music blasting. It was only for a split second, but he caught the feeling of living in a world full of others like him. A nightscape light-ridden with the glow of great cities, the distant roar of interstate traffic and jets thundering through the stratosphere. The sense of not being so goddamn alone. The endlings of their species, of humanity. The speedometer needle edged toward 70, the engine screaming. He'd already blown past the sharp curve ahead sign. Ethan stomped on the brake and lurched forward as the Bronco skidded to a stop in the vertex of the curve. He pulled over to the shoulder, killed the engine, climbed out. Soles of his boots scraping across the pavement. For a moment he hesitated with the door open, staring at the Winchester 97 cradled in the gun rack above the seats. He didn't want to take it for the message it might send to McCall. He didn't want to leave it because these were dark and scary woods and the world they bordered hostile beyond reckoning. There had never been a fence breach to his knowledge, but there was a first time for everything, and being out in these trees in the middle of the night unarmed was just taunting Murphy's Law. Leaning back in, he opened the center console and jammed his pockets full with shells. Then he reached up and lifted the 12-gauge off the rack. It was a pump-action tube feed with a walnut stock and 15 inches of the barrel sawn off. Ethan fed in 5 shells, racked one into the chamber, and set the hammer to half-cocked, the closest thing to a safety on this beautiful dinosaur of a weapon. With the shotgun laid across his shoulder blades and his arms draped over the stock and barrel, Ethan stepped down off the shoulder and started into the woods. Colder here than in town. A yard-thick blanket of mist hovered over the floor of the forest. The moon had yet to clear the wall cliffs. It was dark enough under the trees for a flashlight. Ethan turned on the beam, moved deeper into the woods, trying to keep on the straightest trajectory possible so he could find his way back to the road. Ethan heard the electrified hum before he saw it, cutting through the mist like a sustained bass note. The profile of the fence disappeared in the distance, a rampart running through the forest. As he drew near, details emerged. 25-foot steel pylons paced 75 feet apart, bundles of conductors stretched between them, separated every 10 feet with spacers, the cables 1 inch thick, studded with spikes and enwrapped with razor wire. There was ongoing debate within Pilcher's inner circle regarding whether the fence would remain viable in a loss-of-power situation, whether or not the height and the razor wire alone could keep the Abbeys out. Ethan figured there wasn't much of anything that could stop several thousand starving Abbeys from tearing through if they wanted, with or without electricity. Ethan stopped 5 feet from the wire. He broke off 2 low-hanging limbs and marked the spot with an X. Then he headed east, walking parallel to the fence. After a quarter mile, he stopped to listen. There was the constant hum, his own breathing, the sound of something moving through the forest on the other side of the fence, footfalls in pine needles, the occasional snap of a branch. A deer? An Abbey? Sheriff? The voice straightened Ethan's spine like an electrical current had ripped through it, and he swung the shotgun off his shoulders and leveled the barrel on Peter McCall. The man stood 10 feet away beside the trunk of a giant pine, dressed in dark clothes and a black baseball cap. He had a small backpack slung over his shoulder. To the pack, he'd lashed 2 plastic milk jugs filled with water, which sloshed as he stepped forward. He carried no weapon that Ethan could see beyond a walking stick with more curve than an old man's backbone. "Jesus, Peter! What the hell are you doing out here?" The man smiled, but Ethan saw fear in it. "If I said I was just out for a late walk, would you believe me?" Ethan lowered the shotgun. "You shouldn't be out here." "I'd heard rumors there was a fence in these woods. Always wanted to see it." "Well, there it is. You've seen it. Let's walk back to town," Peter said. "Before I built the wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out." Robert Frost wrote that. Ethan wanted to say he knew that he'd been reading Frost, that very poem, in fact, just several hours ago. "So, lawman," McCall said, pointing at the fence, "are you walling us in or walling something out?" "It's time to go home, Peter."
"Is it now?"
"Yeah."
"And by that, do you mean my house in Wayward Pines? Or my real home in Missoula?"
Ethan edged forward. "You've been here 8 years, Peter. You are an important member of this community. You provide an essential service."
"The Wayward Light? Come on, that paper's a joke."
"Your family is here."
"Where is here? What does that even mean? I know there are people who have found happiness and peace in this valley. I tried to convince myself I had, but it was a lie. I should have done this years ago. I sold myself out."
"I get that it's hard."
"Do you? Because from my perspective, you've been in Pines all of 5 minutes, and before they made you sheriff, you couldn't get out fast enough."
"So what changed? Did you actually make it?" Ethan set his jaw.
"You made it past the fence, didn't you? What did you see? What turned you into a true believer?"
"I hear there are demons on the other side. But that's just a fairy tale, right?" Ethan set the butt of the Winchester on the ground, leaned the barrel against a tree.
"Tell me what's out there," McCall said.
"Do you love your family?" Ethan asked.
"I need to know." "You, of all people, should—"
"Do you love your family?" The question finally seemed to register.
"I used to. When we were real people. When we could talk about the things in our hearts. You know, this is the first real conversation I've had in years."
Ethan said, "Peter, this is your last chance. Are you going to come back with me?"
"My last chance, huh?"
"Yeah."
"Or what? All the phones will start to ring? You'll disappear me yourself?"
"There's nothing for you out there," Ethan said.
"At least there'd be answers."
"What's it worth to you to know? Your life? Your freedom?" McCall laughed bitterly.
"You call that," he gestured behind him in the general direction of town, "freedom?"
"I call it your only option, Peter." The man stared at the ground for a moment and then shook his head.
"You're wrong."
"How's that?"
Tell my wife and daughter I love them.
How am I wrong, Peter?
There's never only one option.
His face hardened. Sudden onset of resolve. He shot past Ethan like he'd exploded out of the starting blocks, still accelerating when he struck the fence. Sparks. Arcs stabbing into McCall from the wire like blue daggers. The force of the voltage blasted Peter 10 feet back from the fence into a tree.
Peter!
Ethan knelt at the man's side, but Peter was gone. Lesioned with electrical burns, crumpled and drawn. Motionless. Sizzling. Smoking. The air reeked of charred hair and skin, his clothes polka-dotted with smoldering, fire-rimmed holes.
For the best, really,
Ethan spun. Pam stood leaning against the tree behind him, smiling in the darkness. Her clothes as black as the shadows under the pines, only her eyes and her teeth visible. And the moon of her pretty face. Pilcher's beautiful pit bull. She pushed off the tree and moved toward Ethan like the natural fighter she was. Slinking, graceful, cat-like. Complete body control and economy of movement. He hated to admit it, but she scared him. In his past life work with the Secret Service, he'd only encountered 3 pure psychopaths. He felt confident Pam was one. She squatted down beside him.
It's like yuck, but also makes me hungry for barbecue.
Is that weird?
Don't worry. You don't have to clean this up. They'll send a team.
I wasn't worrying about that.
Oh?
I was thinking about this poor man's family.
Well, at least they didn't have to watch him get beat to death in the street. And let's face it, that's where this was heading.
I thought I could convince him.
If he'd been a new arrival, maybe. But Peter snapped. Perfect resident for 8 years, not so much as a negative surveillance report until this week. Then suddenly, he's off in the middle of the night with provisions?
He'd been holding this inside for a while. Pam looked at Ethan.
I heard what you said to him.
There was nothing else you could have done. He'd made up his mind. I could have let him go. I could have given him the answers he wanted.
Pam smirked.
But you're smarter than that, Ethan, as you just proved.
You believe we have the right to keep people in this town against their will?
There are no rights anymore. No laws, just force and fear.
You don't believe rights exist inherently? She smiled.
Didn't I just say that?
Pam stood and started off into the woods. Ethan called after her.
Who will talk to his family?
Not your problem. Pilcher will handle.
And tell them what?
Pam stopped, turned. She was 20 feet away and barely visible in the trees.
I'm guessing whatever the fuck he feels like telling them. Was there anything else?
Ethan glanced at his shotgun leaning against the tree. A mad thought. When he looked back at Pam, she was gone. Ethan stayed with Peter for a long time, until it occurred to him that he didn't want to be here when Pilcher's men finally came for the body. He struggled to his feet. It felt good to walk away from the fence, the noise of its current steadily fading. Soon, he moved through silent woods and mist. Thinking, that was so fucked up, and you have no one to tell. Not your wife, no real friend to speak of. The only people you can share this with include a megalomaniac and a psychopath. And that's never going to change. After a half mile, he climbed a small rise and stumbled out onto the road. He hadn't returned the way he'd intended, but still, he'd only missed his Bronco by a few hundred feet. Exhaustion hit him. No idea what time it was, but it had been a long, long day. A long, long night, and the dawn of a brand new one loomed. He reached the Bronco, emptied the shotgun, stowed it on the rack. So tired he could have lain across the console and slept. The stench of the electrocution was still as potent, would probably take days to leave. At some point tomorrow, Teresa would ask him if everything was okay, and he would smile and say, "Yeah, honey, I'm fine. How are you?" And she would answer with those intense eyes that seemed completely disconnected from her words, "Just great." He cranked the engine. The rage came out of nowhere. He pinned the gas pedal to the floorboard. The tires squealed, bit blacktop, launched him. He tore around the curve and down the straightaway toward the outskirts of town. The billboard disgusted him more every time he saw it, a family with bright white smiles waving like something out of a 1950s sitcom. Welcome to Wayward Pines, where paradise is home. Ethan sped alongside a split-rail fence. Through the passenger window, he could see the herd of cattle congregated in the pasture, a row of white barns at the edge of the trees, glowing in the starlight. He looked back through the windshield. The Bronco bounced over something large enough to jar the steering wheel out of his hands. The vehicle lurched toward the shoulder, beelining for the fence at 65 miles per hour. He grabbed the wheel, cranked it back, felt the suspension lift on two tires. For a horrifying second, the wheels screeched across pavement and his right side dug into the shoulder strap. He felt the G-force in his chest, his face. Through the windshield caught a glimpse of the constellations spinning. His foot had slipped off the gas pedal, and he could no longer hear the engine revving. Just 3 seconds of silence, save for the wind screaming over the windshield as the Bronco flipped. When the roof finally met the road, the collision was deafening. Metal caving, glass crunching, tires exploding. Sparks where the metal dragged across pavement. And then the Bronco was motionless, upright on four wheels, two of them still holding air, steam hissing up through the cracks along the hood. Ethan smelled gasoline, scorched rubber, coolant, blood. He clutched the steering wheel so hard it took him a moment to pry his hands open. He was still strapped into the seat, his shirt covered in safety glass. He reached down, unbuckled the seatbelt, relieved to feel his arms working without pain. Shifting his legs, they seemed okay. His door wouldn't open, but the glass had been completely busted out of the window. Up onto his knees, he dragged himself through the opening and fell to the road. Now he felt pain. Nothing stabbing, just a slowly building ache that seemed to flood out of his head and down into the rest of his body. He made it onto his feet, swaying, tottering. Bent over, thought he might be sick, but the nausea passed. Ethan brushed the glass off his face, the left side stinging from a gash that had already streamed blood over his jawline, down his neck and under his shirt. He glanced back at the Bronco. It stood perpendicular across the double yellow, right side tires robbed of air, the SUV slouched away from him. Most of the glass was gone, and there were long scores across the paint job like the claws of a predator had raked it. He staggered away from the Bronco, following gas and oil and other fluids, like a blood trail up the road. Stepped over the light bar that had been ripped off. The side mirror lay on its side on the shoulder like a plucked eye, wires dangling from the housing. Cows groaned in the distance, heads raised, faces turned toward the commotion. Ethan stopped just shy of the billboard and stared ahead at the object lying in the road, the object that had nearly killed him. It looked like a ghost. Pale. Still. He limped on until he stood over her. Didn't immediately recall her name, but he'd seen this woman around town. She'd held some position of authority at the community gardens. Mid-20s, he suspected. Black hair to her shoulders. Bangs. Now she was naked and her skin a serene, dead blue like sea ice. It seemed to glow in the dark, except for the holes. So many of them. Something clinical, not desperate, in the pattern. He started to count but stopped himself. Didn't want that number rattling around in his head. Only her face had been left untouched. Her lips had lost all color, and the largest, darkest slit in the center of her chest looked like a small, black mouth, open in surprise. Maybe that was the one that had killed her. Several others could have easily done the job, but she was clean of any blood. In fact, the only other mark on her skin was the tire track where his Bronco had rolled across her abdomen, the tread clearly visible. His first thought was that he needed to get the police, and then you are the police. There'd been talk of him hiring a deputy or two, but it hadn't happened yet. Ethan sat down in the road. The shock of the wreck had begun to fade, and he was growing cold. After a while, he got up. Couldn't just leave her here, not even for a couple of hours. He lifted the woman in his arms and carried her off the road into the woods. She wasn't as cold as he would have thought. Still warm, even. Bloodless and warm, an eerie combination. 20 feet in, he found a grove of scrub oak. He ducked under the branches and set her down gently on a bed of dead leaves. There was nowhere to take her now, but it felt wrong just leaving her here. He folded her hands across her stomach. When he reached for the top button on his shirt, he discovered that his hands were still trembling. He tore it open, took it off, covered her with it. Said, "I'll be back for you, I promise." Ethan walked out to the road. For a moment he considered putting the Bronco into neutral, rolling it off onto the shoulder. But it wasn't like anyone would be driving out here in the next few hours. The dairy wouldn't be making its milk deliveries until late tomorrow afternoon. He'd have time to clean this up before then. Ethan started back toward town, the lights of the houses of pines twinkling in the valley ahead. So peaceful. So perfectly deceptively peaceful. Dawn was on the verge as Ethan walked into his house. He drew the hottest bath he could stand in the clawfoot tub downstairs, cleaned up his face, scrubbed off the blood. The heat dimmed the body ache and the throbbing behind his eyes. There was light in the sky when Ethan climbed into bed. The sheets were cold and his wife was warm. He should have called Pilcher already. Should have called him the moment he walked inside, but he was too tired to think. He needed sleep, if only for several hours. "You're back," Teresa whispered. He wrapped an arm around her, drew her in close. His ribs on his left side ached when he breathed in deeply. "Everything okay?" she asked. He thought of Peter, smoking and sizzling after the shock, the dead naked woman lying in the middle of the road, of almost dying and not the first clue as to what any of it meant. "Yeah, honey," he said, snuggling closer. "I'm fine." Chapter 3 Ethan opened his eyes and nearly leapt off the mattress. Pilcher sat in a chair at the foot of his bed, watching Ethan over the top of a leather-bound book. "Where's Teresa?" Ethan asked. "Where's my son? Do you have any idea what time it is? Where's my family? Your wife's at work just like she's supposed to be. Ben's in school. What the hell are you doing in my bedroom?" Ethan asked. "It's nearly afternoon. You never showed up for work." Ethan shut his eyes against a crushing pressure at the base of his skull. "You had a big night, huh?" Pilcher said. Ethan reached for the glass of water at the bedside table, his entire body stiff and brittle, like he'd been broken into 1,000 pieces and haphazardly patched back together. He drained the glass. "You found my car?" Ethan asked. Pilcher nodded. "As you can imagine, we were deeply concerned. There are no cameras near the billboard. We didn't see what happened, only the aftermath." The light coming through the window was sharp. Ethan squinted against it. He stared at Pilcher, couldn't tell what book he held. The man was dressed in jeans, a white Oxford, gray sweater vest. The same gentle, unassuming style Pilcher always sported around town, where people believed he was a resident psychologist. He and Pam were probably seeing patients today. Ethan said, "I was driving back to Pines after Peter McCall. Assume you heard what happened there?" "Pam briefed me. So tragic. I glanced into the pasture for a split second, and when I looked back, there was something in the middle of the road. I hit it, swerved, overcorrected, flipped my Bronco." "The damage was severe. You're lucky to be alive." "Yeah." "What was in the road, Ethan? My men didn't find anything except debris from the Bronco." Ethan wondered if Pilcher really didn't know. Was it possible that the woman in the road had been a wanderer? There was rumored to be a group of residents who had discovered their microchips and cut them out, who had knowledge of the cam replacements and blind spots, people who kept their chips with them during the day, but on occasion would extract them and leave them in bed to wander undetected in the night. Word was they always wore hooded jackets or sweatshirts to hide their faces from the cameras. "It makes me nervous," Pilcher said, rising to his feet, "when I see you wrestling with a simple question that should require no thought at all to answer. Or perhaps your head is still cloudy from the wreck. Does that explain the delay? Why, when I look in your eyes, I see the wheels turning?"
"He knows. He's testing me. Or maybe he only knows that she was there, but not where I put her."
"Ethan!"
There was a woman lying in the road.
Pilcher reached into his pocket, pulled out a wallet-sized photo, held it up to Ethan's face. It was her. A candid shot, smiling or laughing at something off-camera. Vibrant. The backdrop was blurred, but from the color, Ethan guessed that the photo had been taken in the community gardens. He said, "That's her."
Pilcher's face went dark. He returned the photograph to his pocket.
"She's dead?"
He asked it like all the air had gone out of him.
"She'd been stabbed."
"Where?"
"Everywhere."
"She was tortured?"
"Looked that way."
"Where is she?"
"I moved her out of the road," Ethan said.
"Why?"
"Because it didn't seem right to leave her naked out in the open for anyone to see."
"Where is her body right now?"
"Across the road from the billboard in a grove of scrub oak."
Pilcher sat down on the bed.
"So you tucked her away, came home, went to bed?"
"I took a hot bath first."
"Interesting choice."
"As opposed to calling me immediately?"
"I'd been up for 24 hours. I was in agony. I just wanted several hours of sleep first. I was going to call you first thing."
"Of course, of course. Sorry to doubt you."
"The thing is, Ethan, this is kind of a big deal. We've never had a murderer in Wayward Pines."
"You mean an unsanctioned murder?"
"Did you know this woman?" Pilcher asked.
"I'd seen her around. I don't think I'd ever spoken to her, though."
"Read her file?"
"Actually, no.
That's because she doesn't have a file. At least not one that you have access to."
"She worked for me."
"She was due back in the mountain late last night from a mission. Never showed."
"She worked for you as what, a spy?"
"I have a number of my people living in town among the residents. It's the only way to keep a finger on the true pulse of Wayward Pines."
"How many?"
"It's not important." Pilcher patted Ethan's leg. "Don't look so offended, boy. You're one of them. Get dressed, come downstairs, we'll continue this over coffee."
Ethan walked downstairs in a clean, newly starched sheriff's uniform into the smell of brewing coffee. He took a seat on a stool at the kitchen island as Pilcher pulled the carafe out of the coffee maker and poured into a pair of ceramic mugs.
"You take it black, right?"
"Yeah."
Pilcher carried the mugs over and set them on the butcher block. He said, "A surveillance report came across my desk this morning."
"Who was the subject?"
"You."
"Me?"
"Your little temper tantrum upstairs yesterday caught the attention of one of my analysts."
Pilcher raised his middle finger.
"You got a report on that?"
"I get a report any time anyone does anything strange."
"You think it's strange? It pisses me off when your peeping toms watch me with my wife."
"Watching intimate moments is strictly forbidden. You know this."
"The only way an analyst would know that it was no longer an intimate moment was if he had been watching during the intimate moment, right?"
"You acknowledged the camera."
"Teresa didn't see."
"But what if she had?"
"You think there's anyone in town who's been here longer than 15 minutes who doesn't know they're under constant surveillance?"
"Whether they know or suspect, I don't care. As long as they keep it to themselves. As long as they walk the line. That includes not ever acknowledging the cameras."
"Do you know how difficult it is to fuck your wife with a camera over your bed?"
"I don't care. David, it's against the rules and you know it."
For the first time, anger laced his words.
Fine.
Say it won't happen again, Ethan.
It won't happen again, but don't ever let me find out that your analysts are watching. I'll leave them where I find them.
Ethan took a big, hot swallow that burned his throat.
How are you feeling, Ethan? You seem cranky.
I feel rough.
First thing, we're taking you to the hospital.
Last time I was in your hospital, everyone tried to kill me. I think I'll just tough this one out.
Suit yourself. Pilcher took a sip and made a face. It's not terrible, but sometimes I could kill to sit outside a cafe in a European city and drink a proper shot of espresso.
Oh, come on, you love this.
Love what, Ethan?
What you've created here.
Sure, it's my life work. Doesn't mean there aren't parts of the old world I still miss.
They drank coffee, and the mood lightened just a touch. Pilcher finally said,
She was a good woman. A great woman.
What was her name?
Alyssa.
You didn't know where she was until I told you. Does that mean she wasn't chipped?
We allowed her to take it out.
You must have trusted her.
Implicitly.
Remember the group I told you about? The Wanderers?
I'd sent her to infiltrate.
These people, they've all managed to remove their chips. They meet at night. We don't know where. We don't know how many. We don't know how they communicate. I couldn't send her in with a microchip. They'd have killed her outright.
So she got in?
Last night was supposed to be her first meeting. She'd have seen all the players.
They have meetings.
How's that possible?
We don't know how, but they understand the weaknesses in our surveillance. They've gamed the system.
And you're saying these people are responsible for her death?
That's what I want you to find out.
You want me to investigate this group?
I want you to pick up where Alyssa left off.
I'm sheriff. They'd never let me get within 1,000 miles.
After your tumultuous integration, I'm thinking the jury is still out on where your loyalties lie. You sell yourself right, they might consider you a prized asset.
You actually think they'd trust me?
I think your old partner will.
It became very quiet in the kitchen. Just the hum of the refrigerator. Distant, ebullient noise coming through an open window. Children playing somewhere.
Shouts of, You're it!
Ethan said, Kate is a wanderer?
Kate was Alyssa's point of contact. Kate showed her how to remove her microchip.
What do you want me to do?
Reach out to your old flame. Discreetly. Tell her you're not really with me.
What do these people know, and what do they want?
I believe they know everything. That they've gone beyond the fence and seen what's out there. That they want to rule. They're actively recruiting. Last sheriff, they made 3 attempts on his life. They're probably already making the same plans for you. This is what I want you to investigate. Top priority. I'll give you every tool you need. Unlimited access to surveillance.
Why aren't you and your people handling this from the inside?
Alyssa's death has been a big blow to all of us. There are a lot of people in the mountain not thinking very clearly right now. So I have to lay this on your shoulders. You alone. I hope you understand the stakes here. Whatever your personal feelings about the way I run this town, and you've shared them with me, it works. This can never be a democracy. There's too much to lose if everything goes to shit.
You are with me on that, right?
I am.
You run a mostly benevolent dictatorship with occasional slaughter.
Ethan thought Pilcher would laugh, but he just stared across the island, the steam coiling off the surface of the coffee into his face.
That was a joke, Ethan said.
You with me or not?
Yes. But I worked with Kate for years. She's not a murderer.
No offense, but you worked with her in another time. She's a different person now, Ethan. She's a product of Pines, and you have no idea what she's capable of.
Chapter 4 Teresa watched the second hand past the 12. 3:20 p.m. She tidied up the items on her